ければ。
Welcome to the third episode of The Definitives, a limited-time music podcast detailing the makings and legacies of some of the greatest rock albums ever made. I'm your host, Blake Peterson, and today we'll be talking about Remain in Light, the fourth album by The Talking Heads. Whenever the Talking Heads are brought up, my mind moves in the direction of an image rather than a sound. It is an image of the band's frontman, David Byrne, standing at the center of a well-lit stage, wearing a suit and yelling some nonsense into a microphone. He's not wearing a regular suit, mind you, but a silver, three sizes too big ensemble that at once seems to swallow him and turn him into another being entirely. This image is from Stop Making Sense, a concert movie which was released in 1984 and directed by Jonathan Demme, a filmmaker who's best known today for helming movies like Melvin and Howard and The Silence of the Lambs. I'm certain I'm not the only one who thinks of this image when the Talking Heads are casually mentioned. It has always partially encapsulated what the band so effortlessly conveyed during their rise, an unabashed sense of weirdness and fierce idiosyncrasy that was more or less defined by Byrne. It also complements the long-discussed truth that Byrne became increasingly controlling as the band rose in popularity, thus mirroring this idea of Byrne being the center of attention. But the way we latch on to the concept of David Byrne in a big suit could also have to do with the way that, once you watch Stop Making Sense, you really feel as though you've seen the band's essence captured. In the film, which turns a trio of shows from the Speaking in Tongues tour of 1983, we see the band at their full potential, as creative geniuses who made music that was as innovative as it was accessible and thrilling to listen to. In Stop Making Sense, though, we see more than just the band's four key members. In addition to frontman Byrne, bassist Tina Weymouth, guitarist and keyboardist Jerry Harrison, and drummer Chris France, we also see Bernie Worrell on keyboards, Alex Weir on another guitar, Steve Scales offering supplemental percussions, and Edna Holt and Lynn Mabry providing soulful backing vocals. Everything about Stop Making Sense is invigorating. It is so exciting to watch that one could compare it to viewing a really great quality Hollywood thriller. Perhaps that's a broad comparison, but it's hard to think of a movie besides something in line with the action genre that kept me as enamored with what the screen was offering on such a visceral level. I watched most of it a few years ago while running on a treadmill at my university's West Campus gym, and I was so energized by what the Heads were doing that I ran 6 miles without even noticing. That's the effect the Heads have almost always had on me. They possess this strange sort of hypnotic power that dependably thrills me in such a way so many bands can only sporadically achieve. In the scope of Stop Making Sense, this phenomenon is upped by several octaves. The movie, along with Speaking in Tongues, the 1983 LP which inspired the Heads to make the film in the first place, is certainly a milestone. It works as a snapshot of the band at their peak and shows just how much more pulse-pounding a live act the group was when they expanded their membership. But although it is common to fawn over what Speaking in Tongues and Stop Making Sense had to offer, much of what people have come to appreciate about these works was first found in Remain in Light, their 1980 LP. That album introduced the band's now recognizable experimentations with African polyrhythms and outre electronics, a newfound stream of consciousness lyrical style on Byrne's part, and inspired the group to eventually go on a tour that featured a coterie of other musicians for the first time. It was their most experimental and inventive record, too. In my eyes, it's the album everything the Heads' discography stems off. It is a nucleus, a summarization of how fearless the band could be. Remain in Light is also something of a bookend in a very lucrative creative period. In the preceding years, the Heads had been tireless. They debuted in 1977 with Talking Heads 77, then released an LP every year after that until Remain in Light in 1980. 77's follow-ups were dependably fantastic. More songs about buildings and food and fear of music are masterworks in themselves. But it is Remain in Light that is the pinnacle of the idea that the Heads got better and more aspirational with each album. While I think it is their strongest work artistically, it is nonetheless sometimes their most difficult. A handful of songs are certainly affable and mainstream friendly. I'd say those are Cross-Eyed and Painless, The Great Curve, and Once in a Lifetime. Once in a Lifetime, in fact, is one of the best singles and most recognizable singles the group ever put out. It's an existential crisis of a song that has become an almost ubiquitous fixture in 80s rock. Take a listen. But if anything, Remain in Light is among the more demanding facets of the Heads' discography. It is not wall-to-wall bops in the same way Speaking in Tongues is, and it is not at least rollickingly strange in the ways Fear of Music is, for instance. It asks us to sit there and really listen, as evidenced by such odd tracks as Seen and Not Seen and Houses in Motion. Here's an example of the latter song to give you an idea of what I mean. For a long time I felt without style or grace. Wearing shoes with no socks in cold weather, I knew my heart was in the right place. I knew I'd be able to do these things as we watch him digging his own grave. After Remain in Light was released, the Heads embarked upon a promotional tour, which made for the first time in which they acted as a 10-piece. But after that, they went on a 3-year hiatus, making for the first time in which other projects would be pursued by its members. David Byrne would release a collaborative album with Brian Eno, who had helped produce several of the band's projects. Chris France and Tina Weymouth would form the Tom Tom Club, a commercially successful group known for the singles Genius of Love and Wordy Rapping Hood. So Remain in Light is kind of the conclusion of a particular moment in the Heads' career. It marked the end of an unusually productive era, but it also helped inspire its members to explore other musical possibilities through other projects. The group would never again put out anything quite so ethereal and inspired, and that makes its perfection all the more easy to revel in. In the third episode of The Definitives, I'm going to talk about the pre-stages, making of, and aftermath of Remain in Light, the most electrifyingly eccentric LP the Talking Heads ever made. Right after the Heads had finished promoting their 1979 LP Fear of Music at the beginning of 1980, the name of the game wasn't getting back into the studio right away. In actuality, fractures that had begun forming were starting to get bigger and bigger. As mentioned earlier, David Byrne went to work on an album with Brian Eno, which was called My Life in the Bush of Ghosts and released in 1981. Jerry Harrison, the band's keyboardist, produced an album for the underground soul singer Nona Hendrix. Weymouth and France, a husband and wife team that had been married since 1977, were considering leaving the band. Weymouth thought Byrne was too controlling. For almost the entirety of the band's career, he was ultimately the one who was doing the majority of the composing, leaving his bandmates feeling slightly expendable. Weymouth was fierce in her conviction that she and France needed to do their own thing. But while the easygoing France agreed that Byrne was becoming an exhausting auteur, he considered the Talking Heads to be one of the most important things he had ever done, and therefore he didn't want to cut ties with the act. To regroup, he and Weymouth took a long tropical vacation in the Caribbean, both to figure out how they wanted to work with the Heads moving forward, and how to save their marriage, which was feeling the effects of the band's strain. While in the Caribbean, Weymouth and France got involved with voodoo rituals, but more importantly, made some musical discoveries. They often hung out with Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare, a renowned reggae rhythm section based in Jamaica. This friendship got them better acquainted with the Haitian drum style, which would prove to be influential on the eventual sound of Remain in Light, which at that point wasn't totally planned. The vacation culminated in Weymouth and France purchasing an apartment in Nassau, the capital of the Bahamas, located right above Compass Point Studios. The studio, an extension of Island Records, was closed in 2010, but its history is storied. Legendary artists like AC/DC, The Rolling Stones, U2, Grace Jones, the B-52s, David Bowie, and others made some of the best albums of their careers there. It is also notable for being the place the Heads recorded their second album, More Songs About Buildings and Food. Weymouth and France were eventually joined by Harrison and Byrne in the spring. Things were a bit tense since Byrne had just cut the previously mentioned LP with Eno, and had been weirdly indirect about the entire thing. And since Weymouth and France were in the Bahamas to try to figure out whether they were going to leave the band too. Thankfully, everyone eventually came to be forthcoming, even if it did take a bit of time reaching a new understanding. It was agreed that Byrne had been too controlling in the past. In order to healthily move forward, it would be important for everyone to mutually cooperate rather than depend on what their unofficial leader was thinking of. Byrne himself was facing writer's block, and realized that he could not move forward as he usually had. Typically, Byrne would come into the studio with the melodies, guitar parts, and lyrics generally ready. But with Remain in Light, things would have to be more jam-oriented. Not only because that would satisfy the newfound, hyper-collaborative approach the other band members were seeking, but also because Byrne was having a hard time creatively anyway. Said Weymouth years later, quote, "We threw everything that we had previously learned out of the window on Remain in Light," unquote. When rehearsals began, it was clear to everyone that the finished product was going to stand far apart from their previous works. It was the first time they really worked as one democratic unit. While figuring out how to construct some of the preemptive tracks, the Heads used I, Zimbra, a cut from Fear of Music, as a jumping-off point. Here's a clip from that song, which is indeed sonically comparable to the music that would be produced for Remain in Light. After the band began to more firmly grasp the direction they were headed toward, Brian Eno arrived in Nassau. While Eno had produced the Heads' previous two records, he was hesitant to work with the band a third time at the outset. Weymouth remembered that Eno and Byrne had a quasi-falling out during the making of their album, but after hearing scratchy demos of what the band had been up to, Eno was intrigued. Quote, "I absolutely love the direction you're going in," Eno told them. Quote, "If this is the way you want to continue, I'll produce the record," unquote. The Heads were enthusiastic about this offer, and soon Eno brought in Rhett Davies, his engineer. Davies, though, would eventually leave the production, which I'll talk about more later. With Eno's assistance, the band experimented with African polyrhythms, using the Nigerian Afrobeat composer Fela Kuti's 1973 LP Aphrodisiac as guidance. To give you an idea of what Aphrodisiac sounds like, here's a clip from that brief album's third track, Iko Ile. Recording sessions officially began in July of 1980 in Compass Point Studios, under the working title Melody Attack. From the beginning, Harrison said that while the Heads intended to emulate the African music that inspired them, they never aimed for imitation. They wanted to merge the aesthetics of that particular sound with the punk sensibilities they'd mastered previously. Though the process was pretty codependent, Byrne recalls that everyone played their parts as if they were loops or samples, only to be changed when trying to merge all the disparate sounds to make something singular. Here's part of Born Under Punches, which I think is the best example of how the Heads came to fuse together myriad sections seamlessly. Adding to the unusual process, Byrne rarely came into sessions with set-in-stone melodies or lyrics. The music would be so overwhelming and complex that it was difficult to figure out how to vocally supplement the instrumentals in a way that wasn't jarring or uneasy. A spoken word style, while not necessarily overtaking every song, came to be one of the LP's defining characteristics, though much of that work wouldn't be completed until long after the individual instrumental work was finished. Here's part of Cross-Eyed and Painless, which showcases some of the album's most interesting hip-hop-inspired vocals. While musical ideas came about regularly and relatively swiftly throughout most of the band's time in the Bahamas, there were still a handful of problems that plagued production there. As previously mentioned, Eno's engineer, Rhett Davies, quit only after working on the project for a short period of time. Although the true reason why he left has never been definitively sorted out, it is speculated that an argument with Eno about how fast-paced the process was the primary reason. After this, Steve Stanley, an engineer best known for his work with the reggae musician Bob Marley and the Head's side project, the Tom Tom Club, was brought in as a replacement. Worse, there were also still instances of Byrne irritating Weymouth. In later years, she said that some people working in the studio quietly let her know that Byrne and Eno had been erasing her bass parts after she'd leave the studio, re-recording them without her knowledge. Weymouth was mad, but she never actually confronted either man about it. In the morning, before they'd come in, she'd simply remove what Byrne and Eno did and re-record her part. Still, the Heads' time in the Bahamas was much more harmonious than it had any right to be, considering how fraught their relationships were going in. After the majority of the instrumental work was finished in the Bahamas, the band's members agreed that they would take 3 weeks off. They would finish Remain in Light in the New York branch of Sigma Sound Studios. Harrison had to pull some strings to get them a spot there, though. The studios were mostly used by R&B artists and producers. Harrison pretty much just pitched this idea that the Heads would increase the studio's marketability. The decision to take a short break proved itself sort of a mistake, though. Following this brief vacation, Byrne, as he had been before the making of the LP, was suffering from writer's block. This was something the frontman battled often. He was similarly sapped when the band finished making more songs about buildings and food, for example. When you listen to Remain in Light, however, it's easy to see why Byrne had such difficulty attaching melodies and lyrics to the songs. They're so instrumentally dense and so intricate and maximalist, it isn't hard to get into Byrne's headspace at the time. How do you add verses and choruses to songs that have no obvious places to attach words to? To pass the time, more guitar parts were added and other sounds were manipulated, but even this couldn't distract everyone from the fact that Byrne was struggling for way too long. Days of nothingness turned into weeks. France and Weymouth stopped coming to sessions. And when they did, Weymouth would complain that Eno and Harrison's tendency to tinker with the instrumentals out of boredom was ruining the sound they were aiming for in the first place. There came a point that Byrne realized that his usual methods would have to be altered further. While making My Life in the Bush of Ghosts with Eno, Byrne was inspired by the speaking style of televangelists. So ultimately, he decided to extend this influence to Remain in Light. He wanted to embellish the tracks with the same sort of vocal melodrama he heard from talented speakers while understatedly mixing in his political and social concerns. While playing an early version of Once in a Lifetime, which was referred to as Weird Guitar Riff Song, Byrne found himself repetitiously shouting, "You may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile," followed by, "And you may find yourself in a beautiful home." While Byrne was sorting out his lyrical woes, which was luckily easing thanks to his decision to switch gears creatively, Harrison invited in Nona Hendrix, for whom he'd recently produced an album, to sing background vocals. Hendrix lived on the Upper West Side and usually would come down to the studio in the evenings between 6 and 7. Hendrix remembers that Byrne, Harrison, and Weymouth were picky about how she sung. Quote, "Black singers sung very differently," she would later explain. Quote, "Enunciation. David had a very specific way he wanted the rhythm of a chorus to fall. It might not seem right to us when they were singing it, but he had a very specific rhythm in mind," unquote. Harrison remembers that the first time he heard Hendrix, Eno, and Byrne singing together in the studio, he was surprised at how Eno sounded. While as a solo artist, Eno had sounded sort of mannered, which may have been enforced by his English accent, with Hendrix, he was able to let loose. Byrne wrote his last lyric in the summer of 1980, and soon after that, the album, which was still being called Melody Attack, was pretty much complete. But post-production wasn't as much defined by musical rethinking and reshaping as it was clinical necessities like crediting and cover art. Right off the bat, Eno demanded that the album be credited to the Talking Heads and Brian Eno. He believed that his production was so vital to the finished product that it was necessary audiences know from the get-go that his involvement was more intimate than most producers. He felt the same way when he produced David Bowie's Low. And as you might have noticed, he didn't get that request fulfilled then either. So he didn't want to once again lose the opportunity to be credited on the front cover. The Heads, though, rejected this suggestion. Although they were aware that what Eno had helped them accomplish was brilliant, they knew that giving a producer this type of recognition was a bit dramatic. At first, songwriting crediting was similarly sensitive. In the past, Byrne usually received the most reverence, with contributions from others marked when necessary. But with Remain in Light, it was difficult to tell who was the primary composer behind each song, as some tracks inherently belonged to some more than others. To try to sort out the problem, Eno thought of a mathematical formula that would assort royalties based on each group member's memory of their contributions to each track on the album. As such, the Heads scribbled out the percentages that other members had contributed, not including themselves. Because the results were so scattered, though, it was smartly decided that the ultimate credits would read, quote, "All songs by David Byrne, Brian Eno, Chris France, Jerry Harrison, and Tina Weymouth." The names were arranged in alphabetical order for the sake of keeping everyone's egos intact, and everyone was pretty happy with this decision. Figuring out what the cover art would look like was tricky. Harrison had designed the artwork for Fear of Music, and it was nominated for a Grammy. This time around, Weymouth and France were responsible for the cover, and Weymouth decided that she and her spouse were going to use computer animation. The duo drove to MIT in Massachusetts and worked with Walter Bender, its chief hacker. As you might have guessed, making album art using a computer was unheard of and very laborious in 1980, but France and especially Weymouth were determined. It was decided that they would be using an image of a group of warplanes flying over the Himalayan mountains. Since the image of the LP was then Melody Attack, the attack shown on the cover would be fitting. The back of the sleeve would simply be a group portrait of the band. Pictures of the members were promptly uploaded. This was controversial, though, because while Eno was given equal credit, he wasn't included in this artwork. For a time, everyone was satisfied with the design, but after a short period, the Heads began having reservations about the title. Melody Attack sounded cool, but the music in store wasn't exactly melodic, so at the last minute, they went with Remain in Light instead. This moniker, of course, didn't match the original image of the planes, so as a result, the back cover was moved to the front, and the front cover was moved to the back. Throughout this, Weymouth still had the most control. She additionally decided that it would be best if the title was in all caps, bolded, and in some sort of serif font. It was decided later on that the A's on the cover would be inverted as to reflect the shift in sound. At this point, all that was left was the mixing of the album. Sire Records, the label which backed the Heads at this point, were breathing down the members' necks since they were behind schedule. To make things more efficient, Harrison and Eno remained in New York, mixing half the record with the recording and mixing engineer John Podeker. The other half was worked on by Byrne and the engineer David Jordan in El Dorado Studios in Los Angeles. Mixing certainly helped bolster Remain in Light's cohesion, but while it was being finished, everyone started getting anxious. While it sounded great, no one had much considered how this music was going to be played live, and the bands had just booked two gigs, one at Toronto's Heatwave Festival and Central Park's Woolman Rink. Originally, they had planned on mostly playing tracks from Fear of Music, since audiences were expecting that anyway. But the members wanted to test out some of Remain in Light's songs. Eno warned against this, quote, "The music was too dense," he told them, quote, "You need at least 9 musicians," unquote. The members took that to heart. While Byrne remained in El Dorado, completing the mixing, Harrison decided that he would start rounding up additional touring musicians in the meantime. He trusted Eno's judgment, even though the latter said he wasn't planning on touring with the group because of stage fright. Harrison eventually attracted the interests of the bassist Bernie Worrell, the percussionist Steve Scales, the guitarist Adrian Ballou, and the backup singer Dolette McDonald. Nona Hendrix would join the band later on. The expanded version of the group gathered for the first time in Weymouth and Francis Loft. Surprisingly, it wasn't a Heads member who was most influential in carving out the live sound. It was Burrell, a prodigy who studied at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston, who helped get everyone to a comfortable place of collaboration. Near the end of August, just a few days before the Heatwave Festival, the new touring members met Byrne, who had just returned from Los Angeles for the first time. Weymouth remembers Byrne being really awkward around them, which he liked since it undermined his control. With Byrne, the protracted group pieced together a 45-minute set. Then they flew up to Toronto, where they would be playing for more than 70,000 people. The set was dramatically laid out. For the first song, Psycho Killer, only Byrne, France, Weymouth, Harrison, and Adrian Belew were on the stage. For the next track, Warning Sign, Steve Scales theatrically joined in. For Cities, McDonald, who wouldn't be joined by Hendrix for this particular show, strolled onto the stage. Once everyone was spotlighted, Burr made an announcement, quote, "We're not the same as we used to be," unquote. The group went right into iZimbra, which, if you remember, was Remain in Light's all-important starting point. This was followed by the then-unheard tracks Once in a Lifetime, Born Under Punches, and Cross-Eyed and Painless. The show closed out with Fear of Music's Life During Wartime, and more songs about Buildings and Food's cover of Al Green's Take Me to the River. This set was replicated at the Woolman Rink Show, which featured Hendrix. This time, the show lasted 75 minutes, the Heads all being more secure in what they had to offer. Critics and fans were enthused about the Heads' evolved sound. When Remain in Light was finally released on October 8, 1980, Byrne decided it would be best to include a bibliography with the LP's press kit. He would add in a statement that would clarify that the album was predominantly inspired by African rhythms and mythologies, and that he himself had been very influenced by African rhythm and African sensibility, aesthetics and social action in African musical idioms, a book by the musician and writer John Miller Chernoff. France was annoyed when he saw this. He never hit an African drum in his life, and felt like the album's influences were much more varied than what Byrne was suggesting. Weymouth didn't seem to mind. But then she saw the back of the physical album, then she too was annoyed. Below each of the warplanes were the titles of each song, but the credits were not ordered in the way that they had been agreed upon so many weeks ago. Now, to her disbelief, it read, "All songs by David Byrne, Brian Eno, and the Talking Heads," unquote. Even though everyone's names appeared on the inner sleeve credits, the layout, also different, was so messily organized that it was difficult to so much as read it clearly. Weymouth believed Tibor Kalman, a graphic designer, and his company M & Company, who had been in charge of turning her artistic ideas into a reality, had been manipulated by Byrne and Eno. To make matters worse, Kalman and his associates got all of the credit. Even in his 1999 New York Times obituary, it is presented as though Remain in Light's artwork was all his idea. In retaliation, Weymouth began talking trash about Byrne and Eno in public, acidically joking that by the end of Remain in Light, Byrne and Eno were so obsessed with each other and so taken with their own egos that they had begun dressing like one another. In spite of all the behind-the-scenes vitriol, though, critical and commercial reception was enormously positive. Remain in Light charted at number 19 in the United States and number 21 in the United Kingdom, and was immediately a favorite across various publications internationally. The Heads supported the album with a brief promotional tour, but then went on hiatus for a handful of years. Mitchell Cohen of Cream was besotted with the band's offerings. Said Cohen, quote, "It's music that sounds cornered and liberated at the same time, and quickly beyond comprehension," unquote. Rolling Stone's Ken Tucker was similarly enthusiastic. Said Tucker, quote, "The Gambler's aesthetic operating within Remain in Light yields scary, funny music to which you can dance and think and dance and think, ad infinitum." Modern publications like the Chicago Tribune, Slant, Uncut, Pitchfork, the Irish Times, and others have perpetuated this sort of praise. Today, the album is widely considered the Heads' most important work. While most of the Heads' discography is timeless, the later albums have proven themselves not as capably enduring as the band's first few LPs, the group would dissolve by the end of the 1980s. Speaking in Tongues from 1983 and the supplemental Stop Making Sense documentary would act as the arguable climax of the quartet's trajectory. The rest of their output, which would conclude with 1988's lukewarmly received Naked, was an inadvertent comedown, perhaps quickened by the dynamic uneasiness. They officially disbanded in 1991. Public admiration for the band, of course, never withered. It's taken me years to really warm up to the group. Like the general public, I had dependably been infatuated with their most recognizable hits, like Psycho Killer, Once in a Lifetime, and Burning Down the House. And for a while, I didn't look that much further than that. Throughout childhood, my mom, who worked in a record shop for almost all of her college years, consistently grouped the band along with some of the weird groups she'd frequently sell but never necessarily liked herself. My dad has never enjoyed them much either. I'm sure I'm not the only one who often based what they listened to during their childhood, at least somewhat, on the thoughts of their parents. Things changed for me when I watched Stop Making Sense for the first time a couple years ago. In fact, the Talking Heads clicked right then. I instantaneously wanted to know more about this obviously inventive, impressively energetic group. I'd get obsessed with a particular artist and primarily listen to them for months on end, and I've done this for years. The Talking Heads were one of those for me in the summer of 2016. I've mostly considered Fear of Music to be their best LP, but it wasn't until recently that I began to really appreciate what Remain in Light had to offer. Sure, Fear of Music is dancier, and I, Zimbra, is one of my favorite songs ever. But with repeated listens, and as my musical knowledge continues to grow with the passage of time, I've come to realize that Remain in Light is strikingly unparalleled. There are a few albums that so eternally stimulate me in the ways that this particular one does. At the moment, I like the third track on the album, The Great Curve, best. It epitomizes everything the album does so well. It showcases the Heads' way of fusing the commercial with the avant-garde, most effectively conjoins the African and rock sounds sought after for Remain in Light as a whole, and even expresses some of the same energy of their live shows. It's an almost 7-minute long groove, but as it continues to go with other long songs like Prince's DMSR, Grace Jones's Slave to the Rhythm, or Television's Marquee Moon, it is a trip worth taking, keeping in touch with the rest of the album. Here is a portion of it. Some people touch it, but they can't hold on. Thanks for listening to the third episode of The Definitives. This episode was narrated, researched, and edited by me, Blake Peterson. If you'd like to know more about me, I recommend heading over to my website, petersonreviews.com, which focuses on cinema, or my Twitter, at Blake W. Peterson. If you want to follow along with the show, next week I will be discussing Hole's Live Through This. Thanks for listening.